The first intermarriage in my family that I know about was my mother's father and mother. My grandfather, who was a Lubavitch rabbi in the Bronx, married my grandmother, who was from the same Lubavitch community but from Brooklyn, and her family were tailors. In fact, her father used to make coats for the Queen of England. And my grandfather's family, he was already third-generation U.S. rabbi in the Bronx. And her family didn't want her marrying into his family because he was a poor rabbi. And she had come from this tailor's family, which in their community was a very high status position. And so it was an intermarriage of cultural, economic diversity. And well, I'm glad they made it. The second intermarriage in my family was my mother and father. My mother, of course, now the offspring of this ultra-Orthodox family, grew up, she and her sisters, in their first couple years in the Lubavitch community. Very shortly after she was 4 years old, my grandfather had a break from the community. It was 1944. His Rebbe was the one who said, the lead rabbi of the town, was the one who said that Jews of Europe deserved what they got during the Holocaust because they weren't practicing enough and they weren't living well enough by the rules. My great-grandfather said to my grandfather, "I can't leave the community, I'm too embedded here, but you're not, you need to go." And he said, "This God isn't our God, and this is not a community I want you raising my grandchildren in." So my grandfather, grandmother, and my mother and her two sisters left. My grandfather became an ethical culturalist, which means that he gave up on God completely. He joined a community in New York that was built for, well, there were a lot of Jews there who had left the Jewish community because their experience of religion was stifling to them because of the concepts of God that had been brought in. And ethical culture was all about humanity taking care of humanity, and that was the kind of Judaism he had found. He still wanted to be a rabbi, however, so then he finished at, he went to JIR, which was the Reform Movement's seminary in New York, and became a Reform rabbi, because he still wanted to work at a pulpit in a congregation, and the Ethical Cultural Society didn't have that availability. He was the first non-Orthodox, at the time he wasn't Orthodox, non-Orthodox rabbi in New Hampshire. He was in Concord, New Hampshire, and so he raised my mother and her sisters there. Eventually, my mother went to summer camp, which happened to be at Camp Harlem in the Poconos. You too? Me too. So my mother was there, and my father, who grew up in Overbrook, also was at Camp Harlem, and they met there, and they fell in love and got married very, very young. They were still in college. My mother was from this family that was very religious, very spiritual, very connected, but also a kind of Judaism that was about social justice, but no God in their experience of Judaism. My father's family, my grandmother on his side, came from an Orthodox family that had become social communist, and she was raised with social justice and with Jewish holidays, but no ritual at all. My grandfather on my father's side, my great-grandfather on my father's side, came from an ultra-Orthodox family, had given it up completely, but whenever his parents would come to their house for dinner, they always had to serve kosher. My grandmother, who was this social communist, would make a kosher meal. She would smack my grandfather, great-grandfather on the head and make him put his hat on so that his parents shouldn't think that she did this to him. Produced with my grandfather, my father, who was absolutely anti-religion, Judaism, except for holidays. And then there was my mother, who was embedded in the synagogue and in temple life, and that's where she found her existence. And together, they produced three boys, I'm the oldest of which. In the Jewish tradition, in the rabbinic lineage, the oldest son becomes the next rabbi in the generation, so I was set out for that. My father is an attorney, so I followed in his footsteps first. Then I went with my mother's family and did the rabbi thing. But their intermarriage was a kind of intermarriage that I think a lot of us who are Jewish-Jewish couples today faith as intermarriage. And that is where one of the people in the home wants to go to temple, and the other one would much prefer to watch some sports game on television. There are all sorts of variations on that within the Jewish community, but interfaith is really something that all of us have experienced at some time in our relationships. So then there's me. My first synagogue, full-time pulpit was in Dover, New Hampshire, and I was living up there. Now, the book says, wake us up and, you know, cause us to alarm us, wake us up, you know, shock us a little bit. So I don't know if this will be shocking for this community, but I'm actually a gay man, and I was living in Dover, New Hampshire, and as a rabbi, and the congregation was worried that I wouldn't find anybody, because who's going to find another gay Jew in Dover, New Hampshire who would actually want to date the rabbi, let alone the rabbi wanting to date him? So eventually I found somebody. His name is Andrew Martin, and he wasn't Jewish. He was not really attached to much religion at all, but started coming to the temple. He had grown up in Portland, Maine. His parents, for some reason, moved to the only Jewish community in Portland, Maine. It was an Orthodox Jewish community. And he grew up going to bar and bat mitzvah celebrations. Only their parents wouldn't allow him to dance with the daughters. And his community didn't understand why he was always going to bar and bat mitzvah. So he had some history with the Jewish community. Came into the temple. And I knew that we had gotten past the generation where worrying about being a gay rabbi was the issue, but where interfaith relationship was the issue, when I heard distinctly from about the 10th row in our congregation, the president of the temple, who was a friend of mine, a woman, and her best friend were sitting next to each other, and her friend turned to her and said, I know this might sound old-fashioned, but don't you think the rabbi's boyfriend should be Jewish? So we had come into a new era. We had come into a new era where there was really a new issue in the house, in the Jewish house, in the Beit Yisrael, the house of Israel. As a kid growing up embedded in the Jewish world, I went to summer camp every year, Camp Harlem, 7 years. I went to Israel 4 times before I lived there. I went to high school there for a little while. I worked on kibbutz for a little while. For somebody who was so embedded in the Jewish world, but to be an outsider, and I still notice in the text, in the new Reform prayer book, some of the language is exclusive to heterosexual couples who are planning on having children. Always being an outsider on the inside, as I was growing up, I realized I didn't want to create that for anybody else. I wanted to make sure that anybody who walked through the doors of the synagogue would feel like this was their place from the moment they walked in the door. So in my congregation, we changed some of the language in the prayers to be open and inclusive. And from the very beginning, I officiated at interfaith weddings. At the beginning, I thought that I could only do them alone. Later on, I started working with other clergy from other traditions. And then I realized that rather than trying to attract Jews to the congregation, that really what I wanted to do was teach Judaism out in the world. Because I was raised with a sense that what matters, community is very helpful for building relationship and for supporting each other. But if that's all it is about growing this, bringing people in to hold up the walls, that it really didn't offer anything to the world. And that Judaism really has some great values to teach, a kind of questioning and openness and discussion and integrity, about taking a day of rest, about an equality and sharing of conversation, about raising our kids to be able to ask questions and to think, coming to bar mitzvah and having that opportunity to stand up in front of the congregation, not to do some ritual that is not necessarily a part of everybody's life every week, but to actually get up and say, I'm part of the questioning body now that's going to take part in the country, in the culture that we live in, to try to make change. I'm going to be counted now as an adult. What I did was then I left the congregation and I moved out into the world of the internet, which I never thought I could imagine, meeting people and creating relationship and community through the internet. And what we started to find in this organization, interfaithfamily.com, is that by going out and reaching people where they were out in the community not belonging to institutions, that if we could give them some strength where they were, that coming into institutions made much more sense for them. To be out there and not know what goes on here and to feel alienated and to feel alien here was not usually an easy way to be brought in. But to be out there, as Rabbi Egolf, as Jim said, to be out there and to be strengthened out there so that when you raise your level of education and understanding, then walking through these doors isn't so hard. And then also the people on the inside get a sense that what they have is of value, that it really matters. It matters beyond the walls of the synagogue. It's, as the prayer book also said in one of the readings that Jim chose tonight, was that the life doesn't end at the walls of the synagogue, that really we should take in here out into the world. What you're going to be hearing tomorrow, I think, from Torah is this really horrible Torah portion about disease. It is last week and this week are the most challenging Torah portions to the liberal Jewish community in the Torah. So I commend any bar mitzvah who is willing to take that on. The first part talks about disease of the body, and the second part talks about disease of the house. An interfaith marriage, since about the mid-1940s, had been considered a disease of the house of Israel. That it was, in a sense, the community, the Jewish community, was teaching itself that there was this disease out there, people marrying out, as they called it, people marrying out. And by marrying out, they were going to destroy the Jewish community. And so they had, in the 1940s to the 1960s, some ways of trying to stem the tide of this particular disease. They closed the doors to anybody who wasn't Jewish. You couldn't have membership. And if you married out, usually starting in the 1960s, actually, was about the time when people started converting to Judaism for the purpose of being able to come in some way, but not really with any attraction or attention to Judaism, just for the purpose of marriage. So in the early part of the mid-century, the Jewish community was treating the disease by trying to keep it out of the building, and when it came in, kind of putting a coating around it to disguise it so it wouldn't touch anything in the building. And then a little bit later, in the 60s to through the 80s, the way the disease was treated was a little bit different. There were inoculations given in temple. In religious school, we were taught every which way they could possibly try to teach us that we have to marry Jewish. That was the message that kept getting across. And not only that, but summer camp was a way of isolating us from the disease, from the outside world, from the possibility of catching the contagion. So the more they could get us to go to summer camp and the more they could get us to go to Israel, the more we would be insulated and isolated from the contracting this disease. And then, in the third generation of this disease, the community started to notice that the numbers were going down. Synagogue affiliation was dropping. And they hadn't been able to inoculate against it. And the fear of what intermarriage was going to bring to the community started to rise in a level that people started putting money behind population studies, Jewish population studies, so they could point to intermarriage being the problem that's destroying Judaism. Well, it turns out, in the year 2001, when the last National Jewish Population Study came out, they showed that less than half, but almost half of the Jewish community was unaffiliated. That synagogues were not drawing people in anymore. That maybe the disease was working. They never bothered to focus on what it was that was being offered or held in the walls to keep people out, but only focused on the fact that the people out there had some problem, that if we could only fix their problem, they would want to come in here. In the early 2000s, just a couple years ago, the Jewish community started to take a different tack and started to think about intermarriage not as a disease, but actually as a possible cure for dying congregations. Not just because every new family brings money into the community, But because interfaith families, we started to notice, offer something to the Jewish community that we ourselves had stopped paying attention to. By not recognizing that everybody's in interfaith marriage, we only began to struggle with relationship with each other around how are we going to be Jewish when there was a problem, or when a new thing came up like a baby or a kid going to religious school. Who's driving them? I don't want to have to go. If they're going to be bar bat mitzvah, do we have to go to temple every week? You take them. Whatever those pieces are, we weren't really paying attention or sort of wondering what this is all about. One of the gifts that the interfaith community has given us is the ability to look at what does Judaism actually mean to us. Because they have to look at it. They have to wonder out loud what it is that they want to create in their house as a religious home, as a spiritual home. What are they going to talk about when they talk about God? What are they going to talk about when they talk about raising their children with values and within a community? What is that going to look like? How is the home that they build going to be an example or a model for the larger community outside, for the world? Are we isolationists? Are we a community that says you have to have a particular identity to be one of us? Are we a community that says, if you want to be a part of us, we welcome you, no matter what your identity is? We have something to offer, and you know what? You might have something to offer us too. That's one of the big pieces that interfaith marriage has offered to the Jewish community, and that is that the interfaith community says to us, you have to figure out what it is that really is important to offer the world. Because you're not going to get by anymore on what your parents and your grandparents and your great-grandparents gave you, which you know already isn't working anymore. So are we going to just keep it going? The interfaith community says stop for a minute and notice what it is that you're offering and really think about it. What is important? Is Israel important? How do we make that? How do we get the message of Israel across in a world where Israel's got so many issues, internal issues that they're dealing with, and we've got a Jewish community in America that doesn't really have an identified sense of how it wants to affiliate with Israel anymore. The interfaith community brings up, what is Israel to you? Why should we be a part of this? Why should we care about this? Where is that connection? What does it mean? What's it going to mean for our children? Also, worship is one of those pieces that the Jewish community has sort of, for the most part, given up on. Although some synagogues are growing and are filling, statistically, it's insignificant. I just read a study recently that said for every 100 Orthodox Jews, Jewish parents, there are 129 Orthodox Jewish kids. For every 100 liberal Jewish parents, Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, 55 Jewish kids. As big as the synagogues can get, the numbers are going down. And so what are we about? What do we care about in the next generation? Are we going to be able to build community for the next generation? The interfaith community is calling us to question on this also. I think that in the same way that in my generation that the gay community challenged the liberal Jewish world to say, who is it? What is it that you're really about? If you say you're about social justice and we're not included in this piece, do you really have integrity about what you stand for? And if you say now in this generation that we're about inclusion and we're about welcoming and we're about the fact that Judaism has something really valuable to offer the world, how does that sit with how we hold interfaith families in our community? I think that you have a gift here. You have a rabbi who's very open and welcoming. You have music and you have a beautiful building and you have a community that is very connected with the interfaith community around here. It's a little weird for me sometimes to come to a synagogue and to talk about this with intensity when in reality the community is an interfaith community. So I'm not yelling at you. But I do want you to notice where it is that you are, where are you on that edge of comfort and welcoming? How are you dealing with your children and your grandchildren's relationships? What kind of messages are you giving to them? How can we strengthen their connection here when we may have some discomfort about what it's going to mean in the future? And here's one of the biggest things that the Jewish world offers the larger world, that the interfaith community brings to us, and this question brings to us. This is where I'm going to end. And that is, the question really is, when the interfaith community comes in and we build, one of the things that we don't know is what's going to happen to Judaism 3 or 4 generations from now. We don't know that. We are striking out into some territory, and we don't know what it's going to look like. And that is really scary. But if there's one thing that the Jewish community and our stories and our history teach us, that is that when we're wandering in the wilderness, and we're always wandering in that wilderness, that really by coming together and supporting each other and studying together and learning together and praying together and celebrating together and welcoming, then we can face whatever comes along, and we will in fact make it through. Imagine the kind of strength that we could give to the whole United States if, as a community, as a Jewish community, instead of being afraid of the unknown, instead of being afraid of what might happen in the future, instead of building walls and barriers and building up strength to hold in, if we really started to think about welcoming and open and inclusive as the interfaith community is bringing us to, then again, we would then be that model for the future that our ancestors were for us. As we come to Passover, as we come to this season where we have these stories, these really great stories of how do we make it when our strength, we don't know where our strength is going to come from because we feel all alone out in the wilderness. This is the time that we start to really think about what freedom means. Freedom to create, the freedom to change, the freedom to grow, the freedom to include, the freedom to be the values that we say that we're about. Shabbat Shalom.